Barbados, and Terrence Austin Andrew. And we water off and since yesterday, I hear on the radio the Prime Minister say that no water should not be off. And we already pay every bill is up today. I would like to know what's the reason the water gone off. Because we really want water.
All right, let's make a call for that, see if we can get someone on the line for that. Thank you very much, sir. Yes, going back to the NAS, in terms of the question that was just asked, how can that lady get some sort of assistance? Anyone?
Thank you for what you asked the lady to give me a call tomorrow. She can call my extension at 1701, and I can go through her details and see what's happening with her specific case.
All right. We try to take a few more calls for the NAS because we really want to also to get in here the czar and the CMO to follow up on the general situation that came out of the press conference. So we go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Go right ahead with your question.
The checks normally come in two forms, right? One early and one at the ending of the month or so. Can we not change all to one time? Instead of, because this thing, we don't know how long it is going for. And another thing, the banks ain't open to take our money. So I still want to know what sense it make that they're giving me the checks and we can't get it changed. We get it changed, but we can't spend it. So I just want to know if all two could change one time instead of having to wait until the check time come. Like one coming the 9th, you change it on the 9th, just an example, and then one coming on the 31st, if all can change one time. That possible?
Response, please.
I could just say, though, that I would advise the lady to look into the benefits of going to our direct deposit. With your direct deposit, she'll be able to get all 4 weeks in 1 month. That would remove that so that she can have the full payment, the full 4 weeks of payment, where she would have access to it. With respect to those two checks, though, as she would know, those two checks, one is the date of the current time when the check is distributed, and then there's a second part, a second check, which is 2 weeks later. So that bears that date.
All right, thank you. I have a question here from Roy Raphael, the chairman of the Alliance of Owners of Public Transport. He wants to know if there will be any assistance provided to the PSV owners and operators by the NAS.
Could Mr. Raphael state the nature of this assistance?
Well, I guess the my assumption here would be that they would be paying NAS, because that's the only way they can get that assistance. Or he could be talking in terms of the $600 that you're supposed to be giving to the families. But if that the $600 would be at the welfare department.
Yeah. That's why I asked for clarification of the nature of the assistance, so that he could be properly directed.
Okay. So the fact about it is that only they can only be assisted if PSV operators can only be assisted if they were paying NAS.
I am not sure the nature of the assistance of which he speaks. If there are employees within the PSV sector who have been laid off, they will be entitled to go and make claims for unemployment benefit. If they're owners and operators who are classified as self-employed, where they do not contribute to unemployment benefit fund and therefore are not covered, they would probably have to seek the other funds which are not being managed, those initiatives which are not implemented by the NIS department. So that's why I said he would need to clarify the nature of the assistance which he is seeking.
All right, thank you very much. We go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a quick question. First, again, let me compliment the NIS because I'm an employer and I've been working with them closely during the past week to answer a lot of questions that my company have had. But a quick question we have is, if we've taken the decision to lay off some of our workers, I know there's the drop box, but in terms now with the curfew of getting the green papers to our employees, which we will scan and send to them, they can still email them into the employee U3 address?
Yes. Yes, they can.
Okay, and then the employer now, they can just go and upload to the through the NIS website?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so then I heard someone mention something about copies of the of their national ID card. Would that still be required?
No. Not for those.
Hello?
Did you hear the question, Derek?
Sorry, can you just I didn't hear that part of the question at all.
Oh, sorry. I had heard someone mention that usually for verification, the person would need to submit a copy of their national registration card. Would that still be required?
That was for pension.
Yeah.
Oh, that was only for pension. Okay, great. So I think that answers it for me. So they can either email it in or they can drop it in the drop box.
Yes.
Okay, no problem.
Yes. Thanks for your query, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And thanks for your comment.
Okay.
Thank you if I could just refer to to make some additional comment on the process of claiming unemployment. Is that fine?
Yes, go right ahead.
Right. So if there are persons who have been claiming unemployment recently, let's say when the facility became available, we allow those persons to submit it via email. Now, at this stage, there are persons who would now be claiming, let's say, since March 23rd. Those persons are required to email the termination certificate only. These are what we may call first-time claimants. However, 3 weeks following the date of submission of that certificate, they are required to complete the declaration form, which is found on our website. Now, that declaration form confirms that you remain unemployed. Now, if that declaration form is not completed, we are unable to confirm your employment status and will therefore delay the payment. So I'm saying for those, let me just repeat, those persons who are now applying for unemployment, those persons are not only required, I should say, to submit the termination of services layoff certificate. However, 3 weeks later, they will have to complete the unemployment declaration form. And every 3 weeks thereafter, persons will then be required to complete the declaration form. Of course, then we will send you a reminder by email to ensure that you complete that form. What we've noticed are there are some persons who are now claiming unemployment have been submitting the declaration form along with the termination certificate, but it is not required at this time until 3 weeks later. Let me give you scenario two. There are persons who had been receiving unemployment prior to when the facility became available, but they must complete the unemployment declaration form every 3 weeks to declare their status. Normally what happens is that those persons receive a claimant card. It's called a U5. People know it. It's a beige kind of card. And those persons are provided with a date of 3 weeks following the submission of the form to return to the unemployment section. But now with the online facility, and since persons may not be able to return the claimant card, the unemployment declaration will verify for us that you have not returned to work or otherwise. So some persons were able to submit their claimant cards via Dropbox, and what the NIS has done is returned some of those cards to them in the mail. But let me just make one further point. If you have been re-employed for any reason, you must return the claimant card and indicate that you have returned to the workforce. I know that's a mouthful, but I hope that people were able to understand those two scenarios.
I would also wish to interrupt here. This is a matter as well that will engage the attention of the board on Wednesday, because clearly, for example, people in the hospitality industry who have been put on laid off, say, for the next maybe 6 to 8 weeks, we have to find a mechanism in order to be extraordinarily flexible in terms of reducing the volume of papers sometimes coming to national insurance. So that is a matter that will be considered at Wednesday's board meeting. And once that policy is agreed by the board, the management of the national insurance will be required to communicate that to the public. But we have to become a little bit more flexible. We have to improve ease of access, is what we're doing. I know that the IT manager and his team, and they're working around the clock to improve a lot of the online systems to allow for processing. And we're going to try to make it easier within this period because, truth be told, you can't, and I do not anticipate for those workers in the tourism sector going back to work in, you know, within another two, maybe 5 weeks, 4 weeks. So we need to make it as humanly possible for insured persons to get the benefits in the shortest possible time. So, you know, the national insurance cannot and certainly will not be and must not be perceived as business as usual. We have to change how we operate, and that is a matter that will engage the attention of the board on Wednesday.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Ian Gooden-Edgell from the National Insurance Board, as well as I'd like to thank Ms. Jennifer Hunt.
That's correct.
The NAS director acting. In fact, we would like to make a quick closing statement because we really have to move on. I do apologize for this, but we need to get the czar as well as the CMO on now to just discuss even further what is happening with the COVID-19 in Barbados.
All right, thank you, Sanka Price. Listen, dear listeners, the National Insurance Department, as a responsible employer, will continue to put the safety and health of its employees first, while recognizing the importance of the timely processing of your claims. At this time, please appreciate we are working with a skeleton staff amidst this significant increase in the volume. We have, however, committed to work assiduously to get your claims paid in the quickest possible time. We are appealing for your patience and cooperation in these times, and we do urge you to continue to make use of our online facilities, and at this time, wish you and your families God's continued blessings and protection. I thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mrs. Hunt. And Derek Lowe, thank you very much. Katrina, we didn't hear from you, but thank you. And Norma King. Didn't get the last name, but Norma King Brathwaite. So thank you so very much for joining us. And it's a bit truncated, but you would appreciate that a lot is happening today. So thank you very much. And I'd just like to remind everyone that this program is brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries, Inc.
You do not have to be a roofing expert to know that a metal sheet will rust where it is joined. That is one reason why the beautiful permaclad U-panel and R-panel roof sheet sold at Williams Metals will outlast other roofing materials. Permaclad, colorclad, and corrugated sheets are cut to the exact length that you will need, up to 40 feet and even longer. That means no joins from ridge to eave. Colorclad sheets come with a factory painted finish in white, blue, green, red, brown, and yellow, and are fitted with screws for added resistance, tested to withstand high winds up to 130 miles an hour. Get a rail roof supplied at competitive prices. Delivered to you today from Williams Metals. Simply call Williams at Kane Garden St. Thomas 425-2000 or Lowlands Christ Church 428-1500.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
Welcome back to Brass Tacks. Sanka Price with you along with Ronnie Clark. 4341790. 2 is our call number, of course, and 266-4862. I'd like to again thank the NIS. They were supposed to be on for a little while, and given the volume of WhatsApps and the number of calls that we had coming in, I know people wanted to hear a lot from them as well. But as I said, we have a lot of things happening here. And I'm sure that during the week, I'm getting down to Brass Tacks, we will answer some more of your questions from the NIS. The program manager has kindly given us the little extension for at least another 15, 16 minutes. So in that period, we'll try to get the CMO, the Chief Medical Officer, acting. That is Ms. Dr. Anton Bess, as well as the COVID czar, Mr. Richard Carter. In fact, we have on the line one of them right now. You're our, no, we don't have one on the air right now. But what we'll do is I'll just give a very quick recap what happened today at the press conference. Of course, we were told that we recorded our first death, came last night, 81-year-old man. He had returned to Barbados on March 22nd, along with his 83-year-old wife, and she is also showing symptoms. We have 100 specialists coming in from Cuba today, and they will be tested on arrival. Another set of good news is that apart from the Cubans, that is that the medical facility at Harrison's Point, the 220 beds for treatment, that will be handed over tomorrow, and it will be outfitted as a matter of urgency so that it will soon be able to be pressed into service. And the next set of really good news is that 6 patients are coming out of isolation, and so that those 6 will be 6 less. And the fact that we have 6 recoveries is very, very positive. We have in total, well, up to yesterday, we have in total 56 cases. But as I said, 6 people will be coming out because they have fully recovered. The other set of good news coming is that there are 37 ventilators owned by the government that are ready for use, and there are 11 owned by the private sector that have been placed that the government can use if they need to use them. We also heard that there have been up to yesterday 527 lab tests and 56 cases diagnosed total, and there are 4 who were diagnosed in the last 24 hours. The patients are age between 7, that's 7 years old, to 83 years old. And we also heard that there of the 19 patients at Paragon, that 4 of these patients will be discharged. They're not so good, and that 2 of the patients at the Blackman and Galt, they will be discharged. The not so good news is that at Enmore, which is the where critical cases are kept, 3 patients are on ventilators and 2 others are critically ill. So that's just a quick rundown of some of the things that came out of the press conference. Two other interesting points is that 5 of the ventilators that Rihanna would have paid for, they're supposed to be here next week. But 20 ventilators that were paid for by a philanthropist were seized in the United States, and the government is trying to deal with that situation. So we should have on the lines right now we have 2 of them. Gentlemen and lady, 2 gentlemen, good morning, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, is this Richard Carter?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Richard. And Dr. Bess, are you there as well? Yes, Dr. Bess, okay, great. Mr. Carter, 1 death, and this puts us at another level. I heard you say that. Have you suggested that we're still basically on track, but based on what the responses I've had here on the WhatsApp, people are beginning to say that clearly we're going to another stage. Can I have some response to you on that?
Well, if I can give a preliminary response,
yes.
Sure, Dr. Bess may want to speak from a public health perspective, uh-huh. But in terms of stages, we are basically at stage 3 still in our response, which was defined for us already. The unfortunate death does bring us a sober reminder of the fact that that unfortunate outcomes such as death is associated with this disease, and it also points to us to what we've been saying all along about elderly person and persons with underlying health conditions. So the case of the deceased person met both of those circumstances. What we hope, however, is that this is a reminder to the population that is engaged in, still engaged in the behavior that we've been trying to get them to curb, that is being outside without necessarily having to be so, not observing the practices of respiratory hygiene and hand hygiene, not observing the physical distancing. We hope that this gives a sober reminder to those persons that this disease can have lethal consequences, and is particularly so for persons who are elderly and persons who have those underlying health conditions.
What then would be your advice to all elderly Barbadians, especially those with medical conditions, who want to go for their pension checks, who still go for their pension checks, who still need to go to the supermarkets? What would be your general advice to them right now, given this death?
Again, the advice that we've given has been consistent from the very beginning, to avoid any unnecessary exposure of yourself if you are elderly and you know that you have those conditions. There will be cases where persons will have to, because they have no one else in the home to do those things on their behalf, or because they are themselves fit and so on, and they're over 70, that will have to transact some business. People still have to get their food. People still have to basically get their medications. What we are doing as a government is to put measures in place for persons who are over 70 and who have those conditions to contact the ministry responsible for people empowerment and elder affairs to register that they are in need of someone to either do their shopping for them or to collect their medication. And this will be dealt with through the Ministry of People Empowerment and Elder Affairs. But we advise that wherever possible. And this does not only apply to elderly persons, because as we've stressed on over and over again, even if someone is healthy, young, and able to fight off COVID-19 if they get it, many of those persons live with parents and grandparents, aunts and uncles, who they could be potentially placing at risk.
Okay. And Dr. Best just got disconnected, so we're trying to reconnect with him.
But I'm back on.
Oh, you're back on. Great. Okay, great. Dr. Best, one of the questions here, I'll let you give us an overview first before we ask a couple of questions here on the from the WhatsApp. Go ahead with your overview.
Okay, so you're asking for a statistical overview.
Well, a brief statistical overview, because we I think we had a lot of that already.
Right.
But in terms of, well, let me just go straight into the questions. How soon will we, Harrison's Point, actually get going? We know it's going to be handed over tomorrow, but it still has to be outfitted. So how soon can they actually take patients in?
We're aiming for the end of this week. I can't address all of the logistical issues, because mm-hmm. while some equipment is here, not all equipment is in. Mm-hmm. But the intention is that this by the end of this week.
Okay. And one of the questions here, I am an asthmatic and call the various urgent care providers to find out the asthma treatment. And I was informed that nowhere was nebulizing. Can they advise me what will happen instead, as minutes conk?
Regarding asthmatics, for those persons who are accustomed going to the asthma bay at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, we recommend that you call ahead. The QEH has a hotline. I don't have the number at my fingertips right now, but there is a hotline that you can call. You will be directed as to what to do regarding treatment of acute asthma attack. And for persons who are accustomed going to their private doctors, if the private doctors are not nebulizing, they should be referred also to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. But you must call ahead if this is an asthma attack. And the reasons for calling ahead, as we've said multiple times, is we need to make sure that first of all, we don't want COVID-19 cases to come into our clinic facilities, and we're unprepared for it. So it might seem like an asthma attack to somebody, but it actually might be, there is a possibility that it can be COVID-19 coupled with asthma. So that's why it's important to call ahead so the facility can prepare for you if it's a facility that can manage you. But certainly we don't want a situation in which persons with acute asthma have no options.
Okay, great. Thank you. We also have on the line Dr. Natasha Sobers. Dr. Sobers, welcome.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Good. Thank you very much. We heard about the estimates being presented by the UWI. The acting prime minister made mention of it, but never really gave any full details. Can you give us some details as to some of the estimates that you have in terms of the projection of this virus and how it can spread, the trajectory of infections, that type of thing?
Sure. So we provided a number of estimates. What we did was we looked at what was happening internationally, and we provided estimates for what would be the worst-case scenario if the Barbados government did absolutely nothing. And we looked at the worst-case scenario for acute care bed needs, and we looked at the worst case scenario for critical care beds, and we looked at the worst case scenario for ventilators and also deaths. And we presented these numbers. We also looked at what we would expect to happen if the government then instituted various measures. So what would happen if you isolated cases, home quarantine, mandatory quarantine? We looked at what would happen if we practice social distancing, which is what is on now. So the estimates take us through the numbers that you would expect in the worst case, and then the best case scenarios and various scenarios thereafter. So since our government has already instituted a number of measures, they've already done case isolation, they're already closing the schools, they've already, as of last week, done the social distancing in terms of implementing the curfew, we definitely would not expect the worst-case scenario. So then what we also did was to look at what would happen if persons were not compliant and only, let's say, half the population complied with the measures and the other half did not comply. And so the value now in looking at the numbers is really to try to encourage people to comply. Because if we don't comply, then the numbers for acute care beds and so on can reach in the hundreds. And the deaths could also reach in the hundreds. But if we comply, the estimates are showing that, yes, we will get some deaths, but they could be as low as 20 in terms of compliance. So if we comply with the measures that have been put in place, we're seeing what the effects could be. Versus if we don't comply, it will be as if we did not put on the measures, and the deaths could be in the hundreds, the critical care beds, and the need for those critical care beds will become overwhelming. At this stage, we are not overwhelmed. At this stage, the government is on track for if we only got, I won't say only, but if we got 75 to 80% compliance from the population, the government is on track to handle that. If only 50% of the people comply, we will not be able to manage.
20 deaths if people comply, and if people don't comply, hundreds.
Thanker?
Yes.
So I'm not an epidemiologist, and obviously respect the numbers that have been provided, yes. But I just want to remind persons who will be religiously sticking to numbers, and we know there are people who are like that, remind persons that epidemiological modeling is just that. It is a model. It is not a prediction of what will happen. It is a guidance as to likely outcomes and likely circumstances. And that is mitigated by a range of things. So just to caution persons that nobody is saying there will be 20 deaths or there will be 200 deaths. What we are saying is that these are the likely outcomes based on the models that we're using.
Great. Well, thanks for that clarification. But
yeah, sorry, I couldn't agree more. There are just estimates. Mm-hmm. This is the reason that we also provide ranges. So actually the range is 0 to 20, if you would, or 0 to, so it's really a dependent on what happens, and none of us can predict the future.
Yeah.
So we are recognizing they're just estimates. We recognize that if we put measures in place, we can reduce the impact of the virus. It's generally the message. Mm-hmm.
But I think the message of these estimates, at least people would understand the seriousness of complying. If you don't comply, we have an extreme, this is what can happen. If you comply, this is what can happen. But of course, you plan for the worst, but hope for the best. That's what we have to do. I can tell all listeners now that we have just been given permission to, we'll go right on to 2 o'clock. So we can take some calls. And I think one call is here, so we'll take that call. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. You're on the air. Yes.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Please turn your radio down.
Talia. Hi, good afternoon. I'm just calling to find out a quick question. I had called a gas station earlier today in connection with getting a gas head for my use of my kids. The person at the gas station said to me, I can't get a gas head because they are not allowed to sell anything else besides top-ups and gas. I want to know if gas head does not fall under the listing of gas, and if some person out there could tell me or tell the gas station, yes, they could sell a gas head, or because I really need to get something done for my kids to eat.
Zar?
Again, we have been asking and hoping for reason to prevail, even in the face of all of the restrictions and the regulations that we have put in place. Now, obviously, if persons are allowed to sell gas, but are not allowed to provide the necessary equipment for a person to use the gas cylinder, that makes absolutely no sense. What we do not want, and what we absolutely are hoping will not happen, is that the regular mini marts that are attached to many gas stations will be open for the sale of those items in the mini marts. Of course, allowance has been made for the sale of top ups for persons who need to remain in communication, and for gas cylinders or refill of gas cylinders. And I would expect that if a person came and presented and needed a gas head and persons had it in stock, providing that would not contravene the basic principle of making sure that people can have gas.
All right. You mentioned just now Mini Mart, and I have here, before I go to the phone lines, a question on the WhatsApp. The person says, the acting prime minister did not mention Mini Marts being allowed to remain open, but the Tsar mentioned that they can be open. Can you please seek clarity?
Okay, so what the announcement and the order was for the closure of supermarkets. The order also allowed for village shops to remain open. Now, again, there are many things that are classed as mini marts but are operating essentially in the community and dispensing or selling items to persons. Our concern was the large supermarkets, and they are clearly identified, that were attracting large numbers of people. I did not imagine that the restriction extended to those shops that are operating in communities. Some of them are loosely called mini marts. Some of them are called village shops.
Mm-hmm. But if you can go inside those village shops, if you can go inside those mini marts, again, social distancing would be key.
Yes, the consistent advice that has been given from the very beginning: maintain physical distancing between yourselves and other persons in any circumstance where you are required to be, or where you determine that you have to be outside for the legitimate reasons that people are being allowed to be outside. I must say that if that advice had been followed, even with the 24-hour notice, and people have been chiding the government for giving persons 24-hour notice of the shutdown of the supermarket, but if persons had observed physical distancing, even in spite of the 24 hours notice, then we would not have had the potential problem that we faced 2 days ago, that persons would have maintained the recommended distance between themselves and other persons in the line and thereby protected themselves.
Mm-hmm. The last question about mini marts, before we go back to the phone lines, they're normally very small in size. How many people should be allowed? I mean, in terms of advising the mini-mart proprietors now, how many people should they allow inside their establishment? What's
so
on the criteria?
Sanka, before I give information that is inconsistent with the intent of the emergency order, my advice would be that persons observe the basic principle of maintaining 6 feet between them and other persons. Now, I have seen some of the mini-marts, even before we imposed the restriction, restricting the numbers of people who could come in to one or two persons, depending on the size of the facility. So you can't have an absolute, because these establishments will all vary from in size from one to another. But the idea behind all of this is to protect yourself. Go out only if it is absolutely necessary to do so. And if you do go out for legitimate reasons, that you basically observe the principle of protecting yourself.
Okay, thank you. We go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sanka. I have a question based on a long-time observation with regard to nurses and auxiliary and nursing assistant persons going to and from their medical duties in uniform. And this is even before COVID raised its ugly head. I want to know from the czar or any person who can answer whether or not they will now restrict these persons from wearing their uniforms, especially when they are coming off duty on public transportation, because I see that as a health hazard. We don't know what those persons would have been doing during the course of the day from inside a medical institution, and I don't really think that they ought to be wearing their uniforms coming from work or even going to work on public transportation. If someone can respond, please.
Dr. Bess?
Sure, if I may. So we get this question a lot. And I hope my response gets a little better and a little clearer every time I respond to it. So on a day-to-day basis, the persons working in healthcare facilities are expected to practice what we call infection prevention and control measures. That reduces the likelihood of them acquiring infections and passing on any infections that they may have. There's certain practices that must always be adhered to. With the advent of the introduction of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've had this question locally, if nurses, if staff who wear uniforms when they leave their homes and come into their facilities, if that practice should continue. Once you are adhering to the infection control prevention measures, that is the important thing that we need to focus on. However, if you do have a cadre of staff that are working specifically or exclusively with persons who have COVID-19, it's going to be a little bit different in that you're going to be wearing personal protective equipment. And that protective equipment covers what you're currently wearing. You're going to cover your face with a face shield. You're going to have more goggles. You're going to have a mask. You're going to have gloves. So all of these are measures that reduce the likelihood of picking up infections, microbes, and being able to transfer them to another. Listen, the science and information and data and recommendations are rapidly evolving, so you have to appreciate that protocols are changing with time. So if we are advised by WHO, because this is what was studied in say, China or in another setting that had COVID, that persons need to take off their clothes before they leave, or change their clothes, their uniform, before they leave the institutions, and they need to be disinfected a particular way, then so be it. But suffice to say that right now, the standard infection prevention and control measures still obtain and are still useful in this scenario.
I thank you for your explanation, sir, but I still see this as something challenging for persons in general. We don't know if everybody will follow rules and regulations, and I think that it ought to be something that is implemented where persons who work in medical institutions should not be taking public transportation in their clothing that they've worked for an entire day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We move to another question. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, good afternoon. Am I on the air?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, a couple points within the question. I think earlier, Desire mentioned that if Beijing had responded by, you know, adhering to social distances, et cetera, during that 24 hours that we had to shop, that, you know, we wouldn't have had the potential problem then. But I will suggest that any potential problem that we had during that Saturday, we still have today. Because if, in fact, there were people in some of those crowds who were infected, then that problem may turn up later on. So at the end of the day, if it was a problem then, it is still a problem now. It's not really a problem that has passed. And I made that point because we say that we plan for the worst, but we hope for the best. And I'm not sure that we are doing this at every turn. I think we could probably do better in that. For example, we expected that Beijing would observe the 3 to 6 feet distance between persons. But in reality, we live in Barbados. We have a sense of how people are likely to respond. But in any case, the worst-case scenario was what we saw yesterday. But we didn't fully plan for it. Now, I'm not saying that government needed to plan for everything. But overall, I don't think the stakeholders planned for that kind of response, which was close to the worst-case scenario. But rather, we hoped and expected that Beijing would comply, which is the best-case scenario. So I think we probably need to do a little bit more planning when it comes to worst-case scenario. My second point has to do with essential services. Now, I fully understand the purpose of the 14-day lockdown, because it gives us an opportunity to see where the virus is, because we would have stopped transmission. However, we have essential services, and we have a number of people that work in those services, and I'm glad that people recognize that this group are putting their lives on the line in many cases. They are an at-risk group, because even though we may stay home, we expect and we need for these essential services resources to go out and come in, so that anything that happens outside of a household that may be staying at home, except for one essential worker, if something happens out there as it relates to transmission of COVID-19, it comes in. So this is, in fact, one of the higher risk groups that we have now. And I believe that we need to implement testing. We don't need to wait on this. Just like I believe that when we close the borders, we should have implemented the curfew at the same time. We allow some time to pass for obvious reasons. Okay, fair enough. But we should not delay on having our essential services persons tested. If you have two police officers who go out to a call, they're riding in a vehicle together, they're working in a police station together, there is not the strict social distancing as you may require of the public. So they are at risk there. We need to test those persons to make sure that our essential services persons do not transmit while they're doing good, that they don't inadvertently do what we don't want, that is transmit others. So I think that we need to bring forward any plans that we have for testing our special group of people who go out to help the needy. closing comments on one question. We've talked a lot about prevention. I think we've done an excellent job in trying to educate the country. So what I would like to find out is, do we have a plan to educate people about treatment of it? And I'm not speaking in terms of a doctor. In terms of if I'm at home, and if I'm at home that has contracted or is in quarantine or whatever, and it is a mild case, I'm not sure that we want those persons necessarily to leave their home and go into a facility. If it's mild and we believe the patient can ride it out, what is the advice to those people?
All right, sir. Thank you very much for your contribution. We'd like to get a response, please. Dr. Bates.
Sure. The first question that I'm going to respond to is about the mass testing. And the question that I would ask in response to the question is, what's the justification for it? We're not advocating mass testing of persons who are asymptomatic simply because it doesn't yield any benefit. It's going to tell you what their status was on that day, but it does not mean that the previous day they could have been exposed and they're incubating. So there's a time from exposure to the time the person actually manifests the infection, and it's the time when the person manifests the infection that the test becomes positive. So there's no justification for it from many different angles. This is why we focus on the prevention messaging. We advocate for people to practice good hand hygiene, which is washing your hands with soap, use of alcohol-based hand sanitizer in between. We also advise people not to touch their face. Keep your hands out away from your face. That's how you pick things up, and that's how it gets into your system so the infection can begin. And then we also advise people on respiratory hygiene. So it's important to appreciate that you're talking about mass testing of persons who have not manifested infection. But if somebody becomes ill and they have respiratory symptoms, that is when we want them to interact with the healthcare system. That is when we want them to call their regular healthcare provider and said, look, I have a cold, I have a fever, I have a sore throat, I'm short of breath. What should I do? Because that person may have COVID. And it is at that point that we can kick in certain measures to reduce the likelihood of them spreading. And of course, that's when we test. The other thing about the logistics of testing is you're talking about thousands of tests that are required. We don't have the capacity. We don't have thousands of tests to test asymptomatic people. We have to be very judicious in the use of the few resources we do have. And that is why, that is yet another reason why testing of persons, asymptomatic persons, simply is not strategic. It's not wise on our part as a Ministry of Health and Wellness. And you must forgive me, but I did not hear the follow-up question.
All right. What I will ask you, though, is how many tests can be done on a daily basis? What is the maximum?
What I will tell you is we have done up to almost 50 tests in one day. We do have the capacity to go up to 100 tests. We do have the capacity to go up to 150 tests. And that is based on the ability of the lab to receive that many samples and produce the test results that we get in a timely manner. It will mean that some of the other services in the lab would have to shift. So other things that we do on a daily basis will have to be put on pause because you will require more staff to be able to run those tests. So we have looked at those, if we scale it up to as many as 150 tests a day. We haven't looked at going beyond that. But the other thing is we have to get the equipment. We have to look at nasal swabs, which is what you take the biological sample with. And we also have to ensure that we have sufficient reagent. So while we have sufficient reagent to last us quite some time, if we started doing mass testing, it simply isn't feasible. Sankar, if you could help me, the second part of the question was also related to prevention, but I didn't get all of the question.
All right. I didn't make a note of that aspect either.
Sankar, yes. I do recall that the person was asking about if a person develops a mild form of COVID-19, what advice we would give them in terms of remaining at home and treating it at home.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I believe the CMO would have some very clear advice in relation to that.
So At this current point, we are in stage three, which is the third and final stage, but appreciate that there are different degrees of seriousness or burden of the epidemic. We are not yet at the stage where we would advise persons who believe they have COVID to just stay home and to ride it out. But appreciate that in some countries, in some jurisdictions, that they because the healthcare systems are so overburdened, they have no alternative. So people who suspect that they have COVID-19, if your symptoms are mild, it's a mild fever, it's a mild sore throat, you came into contact with somebody who was a likely COVID case, please don't come to the healthcare system, because the healthcare system is only seeing the more serious cases. Barbados is not there yet, and we don't want to get there, because when we get there, it means that our healthcare system is overburdened and overrun. So at this point, if we are encouraging doctors to have a high level of suspicion for the possibility of COVID, they call us at the Ministry of Health, or they call the hotline, they refer cases to us. We want to capture all cases of COVID that are potentially out there, because that is the way you're going to detect and you're going to isolate. Therefore, you can contain and limit the spread of the virus. Right. So it was a very good question from the caller. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Let's take another call. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Go to another call. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
I have a question for either the CSR or the chief medical officer.
Go right ahead with it.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question. I think during your press conference, you had said that a gentleman came in on the 22nd of March. Mm-hmm. And when he came through, was he on a list of potential COVID cases? Because by my calculations, I could be wrong. I think you guys had said that he actually had the pneumonia, which from what I've heard is like the last stages or one of the worst stages of the COVID. So can you tell me if during that period he was actually on a list of potential COVID cases, or is it a situation where he just appeared last night and he was in respiratory distress? Because right now, as a citizen, he had, if he was not on like a list or something, he had a more or less like an 11-day head start on the ministry officials.
Yeah, very good question. The history that I understand so far is that he would have come in 2 weeks ago today. So one day shy of 2 weeks, he would have presented to the health center, the health facility yesterday. I do not have all the details in terms of when his symptoms started, but appreciate that at the time that he came in, they would have been screened. All passengers coming in would have been screened. We would have wanted to know if you travel from countries, specific countries, they would have been temperature screened. They would have been asked about symptoms. But so let us assume that when he came in, he had no symptoms, because it would be a bit surprising if he came in and had symptoms. And because that, in fact, I'm pretty sure that that was not the case. Poor health would have alerted us, and he would have been screened even further if he had symptoms. What I cannot tell you is, did his symptoms develop 2 days earlier? Did they develop a week ago and he thought that it was just a regular flu or a very bad cold? I don't have those details at hand.
But my thing is, I thought that when you came through the airport, from what I assumed was happening, is that when you came to the airport, you were and you came from any of the COVID hotspots. Your thing is that you had to self-isolate, excuse me, and report to ministry officials. So the mere fact that I'm being told no, that this probably did not happen, and he presented yesterday with the more serious COVID symptoms, I am literally afraid. He has a head start. Like, in order for you to contact trace every single person that he would have probably been in contact with in the past 11 days, it's virtually impossible.
And Don't say it's virtually impossible. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. But our contact tracing process would have started today. So that is why I don't have all the information. It takes a couple of days to compile that list and to get out to people and say that you were exposed to this particular gentleman. So we therefore think that you're exposed, so therefore you have to quarantine. So that contact tracing process is a very detailed, very labor-intensive process that is only now beginning. So that's why I don't have all of the information on him, when his symptoms began, who he came into contact with, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, thank you.
All right, just let me get a question in here. What measurements or indicators need to be met to decide if the curfew will be extended after April 14th? Can anyone answer that?
I am not in a position to say what measures will be, because that is being very prescriptive. However, the government is constantly taking the advice of the Ministry of Health, and it is a balance between the number of cases that we are seeing and the capacity of the government to treat those cases. If at the end of the next 10 days and we are in a position where we've seen an explosion of cases and they're potentially overwhelming the capacity of the government to put persons in care, that will obviously be a situation where you will have to consider extending the period of restriction, as has been done in a number of places. There is going to be an assessment done of the restrictions that are currently obtaining, and we can rest assured that there are discussions going on as well with the retail and distributed sector to ensure that even when we do allow the supermarkets and other business places to reopen, as they will have to do for at least some period after the next 10 days, then those openings and those arrangements will be made in such a way that we minimize the level of exposure that we've seen persons subjecting themselves to. We are currently discussing a range of systems by way of either curbside delivery or curbside pickup, rather, delivery, or some other means where we restrict persons in the days that they can shop by their surname or by their national registration number. So all of those discussions are now going on as to the best way to allow persons for the capacity to go and restock, to do their shopping, but to do it in a manner that is more controlled.
All right, we go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Just one quick question. The minister spoke about some assistance via health persons coming into the island tomorrow. My question is, when these persons arrive, these 100 persons, will they be either quarantined for 14 days or will they be tested as well?
That was answered at the press conference, sir, but I let the Dr. Bess answer that one.
Thank you.
Sure. So what the Minister of Health indicated during the press conference is that they've already been tested. They've already been screened prior to leaving Cuba. But in addition to that, we're going to put some other measures in place. We'll do our own screening from a port health perspective. And we are in discussion with the Queen Elizabeth Hospital about those other measures that we're going to put in place. So we are cognizant of the fact that that they're coming from somewhere and which does have COVID cases, just like Barbados. We don't want to let in persons who have COVID. So that is why the screening is important, and especially since they're going into a healthcare facility to work. So we are looking at all angles to reduce the risk of spread in Barbados.
Dr. Best, before we go to our next call, here in the WhatsApp, we're being asked again about the testing of any frontline workers. Can you tell us if any of them have come down with COVID? That is, any nurses, any doctors, any police, any soldiers? Are you aware?
At this point, Sankar, I'm not in a position to respond to that. There are certain things that we are investigating, but I can't respond to that.
Okay.
But we are, what I will say is that in terms of healthcare workers, we place a tremendous amount of emphasis on protecting them from COVID. And we have also been in discussions with persons from the police.